talk given Saturday, 8th May 1976. We have all heard of the recent disaster, the earthquake, which has brought so many deaths, so much destruction of homes, so much distress, suffering, misery to thousands of people. And this sort of event happens again and again in different parts of the world. If we ourselves live distant from the scene of disaster, we are not quite so sensitive to the suffering that people undergo. If we are closer to it, if we ourselves are involved in it, then it is a very different story. And we need not necessarily be closer only in terms of distance, but we could be very close if someone very dear to us has been involved in it. As for those who get killed, it's short, sharp, and terrible for us who are alive. But those who get maimed, perhaps for life, or perhaps those whose minds, because of the terribleness of the event, experience mental derangement, it is really a lifelong misery. And this is not the only form of suffering that afflicts mankind. All through the ages, there are various types of affliction which the human race suffers from. One of the commonest, of course, is personal illness. One falls ill, undergoes pain, perhaps experiences some disability which may last for years or even for a lifetime. So there is that to be taken into account. Or there is the deep emotional and intellectual distress born of human relationships which are not satisfactory, or even worse, have become intolerable, and one doesn't know what to do or how to act in a situation from which there seems to be no escape. All these problems of human suffering are constantly with us. And the question arises, in what manner shall we, as people who are deeply concerned with the religious life and who believe that we are sincerely committed to living up to the highest possible standards. How are we to approach such situations and such problems and understand them? And let us, as one example, consider this question of illness, and especially with advancing years, the question of illness, the problem of death. The fear of death is the supreme fear afflicting man. But we must remember that it is not the actual death of the body that afflicts me, the individual. Because when I'm dead, I'm dead. There is no affliction. It's the other people who are left behind who feel the shock, the misery, the sorrow. And I'm sure some at least will be delighted that I'm out of the way. So there's no special problem for me, myself, where the death, the actual physical death of the body is concerned. It is the idea of relinquishing being inevitably and forcibly deprived of physical existence here, which is the problem. Supposing young and vigorous and healthy and strong, and suddenly there's an accident, and I'm just killed on the spot. Well, when I am young and vigorous and strong, there is no problem of death. I take it for granted I shall live 60, 70, 100 years or something like that. There's no problem of death. But when we talk of the problem of death, we are talking really of the complete unwillingness of the average individual to relinquish his physical existence. He holds on to it, and he wants to hold on to it as long as possible. This is the problem where death is concerned. Now, there is the man of the world. What of the religious? How should the religious person understand and approach this situation? The orthodox teachings of the different religions present the idea of living the good life, overcoming evil, not fearing death. Because if one has lived the good life, there'll be a very secure and comfortable and pleasant hereafter. Now, of course, for those who cannot go deeper than that into the true nature of things, that is a comfort and a consolation, and incidentally a help towards living a life which otherwise might have been far more harmful to the environment and to themselves. But for us, you and I here, there is something much deeper, something far more extraordinary, truly extraordinary. And I think one of the most interesting forms in which the approach and understanding of this problem is presented comes in the Buddhist texts, a form which is quite different from the forms in all the other major religions of the world. And I'll take as one example the account given of one of the Buddha's monks, Vakkali by name. Vakkali fell ill, seriously ill. He wasn't getting better. And he called upon those who were attending him to go to the Buddha and say to him, "Lord, the monk Vakkali is sick, afflicted, stricken with a sore disease. He worships at the feet of the Exalted One. Well were it, Lord, if the Exalted One would visit Brother Vakkali out of compassion for him." Not carefully, out of compassion. There is no request that the Buddha should come and perform some miracle and raise him to life and health again. This is the request, that the Buddha should visit him. So these attendants who are looking after Vakkali, they go to the Buddha and give his message. And the Buddha consents to come along and visit Vakkali. And then the conversation goes along these lines. Now, this is the usual way in which such events have been recorded in the Pali Canon. It's more or less a sort of a standard form, but the actual conversation that takes place has certain variations depending upon the particular monk concerned. So when the Buddha approached Vakkali, he said, "I hope you are bearing up. I hope you are enduring. Do your pains abate and not increase? Are there signs of their abating?" And Vakkali answers, "No, Lord, I am not bearing up, not enduring. Strong pains come upon me. They do not abate. There is no sign of their abating, but of their increasing." Then the Buddha asks, "Have you any doubt, Vakkali? Have you any remorse?" "Indeed, Lord, I have no doubt, I have no remorse." "Have you not anything, Vakkali, wherein to reproach yourself as to morals? Then, no, Lord," answers Vakkali, "there is nothing wherein I have to reproach myself as to morals." Then, Vakkali, "If that is so, you must have some worry, something you regret." This is what the Buddha deduced from Vakkali's request to the Buddha to come and see him. And Vakkali says, "For a long time, Lord, I have been longing to set eyes on the Exalted One. But I had not strength enough in this body to come and see the Exalted One." Obviously, it was a very long illness. "Hush, Vakkali, what is there in seeing this vile body of mine? He who seeth the truth, the Dhamma. He seeth me. He who seeth me, Vakkali, he seeth the embodied Dharma, the embodied truth. As to this, what think you? Is body permanent or impermanent? The words used are anicca for impermanent and nitya for permanent. But those words have a far fuller meaning and a far profounder meaning than just permanent or impermanent. Nitya, the Sanskrit nitya, means literally the eternal, the absolute, the transcendent. Anicca means that which belongs to time and therefore to the sphere of mortality. That's why they translate it as impermanent. Anicca is the relative, not the absolute. And Vakkali answered that the body is impermanent, Lord. Is feeling or perception, the states of consciousness, anything, is it permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord, answers Vakkali. Wherefore, Vakkali, says the Buddha, he who thus seeth, he knows that neither the body, nor the psyche, nor anything you may ascribe as composing the living organism is the ultimate real. It is not mine. This is not the absolute. And if he really knows that, life conditioned by body, by psyche, by mental patterns, by consciousness, life has no hereafter under these conditions. Note carefully, it's the freedom from the conditioned state which the Buddha is presenting to him. The freedom from all limitations. The freedom which is born of the inward realization of transcendence, which spells the dissolution, the cessation of everything that is conditioned. Body, psyche, intellect, everything is conditioned. Everything is limited. It spells the cessation. And the teaching involves one of the supreme teachings of the Buddha, not to grasp at anything, not to cling to anything, not to desire to possess, to hold on anything. Everything arises, proceeds, dies. Any and everything comes to you in time, and necessarily there is the dissolution of that particular thing. Therefore, those are the things which one must not grasp. Then there is the reality of complete and utter inner freedom whilst you are still alive in the unfree state, the bodily state, the psychical state, the state of inspiration, the state of profound modes of consciousness, and all the rest of it. They all belong to time. That is not the timeless, eternal reality. And all that belongs to time belongs to the realm of the ill, the sorrowful. Existence, that is why the Buddha taught that all existence is ill, dukkha. Far from the infinite. That's its real meaning. Not just pleasure, pain, joy, sorrow, which come and go ephemerally from day to day. You can take all that in your stride. But if one is far from the infinite, not in the supreme communion continuously, then that is the state of the supreme sorrow, the transcendent sorrow. You see, therefore do not cling to anything which belongs to time and mortality, but let attention be such that one is continuously in the state of communion within the absolute. The unknown and the unknowable. Unknown and unknowable because what we call knowing and what we call knowledge is something which is finite, limited. Therefore belonging to time, therefore the ill state. And all existence is like that. The very word existence means to stand outside of the transcendent reality. Ex sistere. Ex out of sistere, to stand. See, you stand outside the absolute ultimate reality. You see the point of it? Now, having said that, having said those words, the Exalted One, having thus taught the Venerable Vakkali this lesson, rose up and went away. Not long after the departure of the Exalted One, the Venerable Vakkali called to his attendants and said, "Come here, friends, lift up my bed and go to Black Rock on the slope of Sears Hill. How should one of my sort think to make an end within this house?" The body. Now note a very, very important point, it gets involved. The attendants do what he asks them to do. Then comes a very important stage. After the Buddha has gone away, he sees with his profound insight just what would happen. But he also sees the state, the liberated state of consciousness, of mind, of Vakkali, before he performs the act. And the act is the act of what we commonly call suicide. When the illness, when the pain is completely beyond all bearing, and at the same time, when the monk's mind is so poised and calm and set upon the transcendent real, in communion with the transcendent real, then he takes a knife and kills himself, kills the body. And the Buddha says, in connection with that, "Fear not, Vakkali, your dying will not be evil. Your ending will not be evil." When the mind is so completely poised, when all separate selfness is gone, when there is not any clinging or attachment or desire to bind the person to anything whatsoever in all existence, then suicide is not an act of destruction, of killing. And you see, some scholars have thought that Buddhist teaching condones suicide. It doesn't. You have to be in this perfectly liberated state of mind. And then you are out of the sphere of birth and death. You are in the sphere of life, the reality of life, which is eternal life. And I say you are in that sphere because the body is still alive. And whilst the body is still alive, there is a you. There is an identifiable person, a you, whilst the body is alive. So in that state, this utter freedom is realizable even through the act of killing the body, putting an end to it. It is not in order to escape from the pain, to escape from the misery. If a monk were to commit suicide in the ordinary way, as an ordinary man of the world might do it, because it's so unbearable that I must get rid of it. You see, the monk is not trying to get rid of the pain at all. He is in complete and total communion in that state of cessation, realized transcendence is there. This particular vehicle, this house, as he calls it, is no longer necessary. And since it's a house which means trouble for others, for those around, looking after him and so forth, which is an obstruction in the way of the progress of other people, therefore he puts an end to it, making an end of it. See? Now what is the essential point of this? It emphasizes for the religious, whoever he may be. He need not be Buddhist, he can be anybody. If he's a religious man and truly concerned, it emphasizes the supreme importance of realizing the state of communion, of complete at-one-ment with reality. If that at-one-ment is there, there is no separating, isolative self-consciousness present. And if that is absent, it means also that that man has realized human perfection. He is the perfected Holy One. Utterly free of all grasping, all clinging. All of it, including clinging to ideals, to what we commonly call high principles, standards of conduct and morality and so forth, to profound ideas and concepts and whatnot. All those are out of the picture. Now that sort of person is the realized person. And if this state comes about, then anything like personal achievement is completely out of the picture. There is no separate personality. The timeless, the infinite and immeasurable, the absolute, has manifested itself through that which belongs to time and mortality, the finite, the limited, the mortal. And that means that the supreme purpose of man's existence on this planet has been made manifest. Jesus made manifest the supreme beatitude through the transcendent passion. The Buddha manifested the supreme beatitude through transcendent wisdom and compassion. Zarathustra manifested it through transcendent purity, and so on. Each in his own unique way. And you and I have that same vision before us, our own individual vision it will be, our own individual way of manifestation. Now let us look again at the way you and I are not transcendent or perfected holy ones of that caliber. How do you and I, how may you and I approach illness, problems, and so forth? If we have the vision, or at least some sort of light, some sort of vision of what is trying to emerge out of each individual human being and his existence, if we have some sort of vision and real understanding of it, then we shall cease to think in terms of ought to be's, what ought to be. Because any ought to be is pictured by oneself. What, you may ask, will then take its place? Now you see, the very question involves our wanting to be tied to something limited and particular. We want something to take its place. Anything will always be limited and particular and mortal. We must see that first and foremost. And insofar as it applies to us, we will find that in every case, what we want in its place is something which we like, something which we desire. Now we must be free of making the other mistake of saying, oh no, we must perform our duty, come what may, in terms of pain or sorrow or difficulty or misery, illness, anything. Well, I'll do my duty till I die. Now you see, that is not altogether wise. Because if one compels oneself to what one with one's own imperfect mind sees as a right course of action, there will be inner conflict, which will again upset the apple cart somehow or other, cause trouble. This is an extremely difficult problem Let us sort of go deeply into it with all our being, so that we really understand. This state of conflict is something we have to avoid. The intellect may see duty as such, but if it completely crushes the heart, everything that we do or try to do in order to fulfill duty will be poisoned by the crushed heart, because out of the depths of the subconscious, the unconscious, there will always act a contrary psychical force. I am doing this because it's my duty, but I don't really want to do this. So that if I, the doer, am torn between two opposites of that sort, one destructive, the other constructive, as I imagine them to be, as I imagine it to be constructive. The destructive is a fact. The constructive may or may not be the case. You see, if one is in that court between the jaws of that nutcracker, invariably there will only be a misapplication of energy. And what emerges out of that misapplication will fail to be truly in line with the sweet purposes of life in its transcendence. Now, you can't make the heart fall in line with the head. You can let both head and heart find release in such a manner that there is wholeness of one's entire psyche, one's entire mind, and a transcending of the conflicting duals. Now the question arises, you will naturally ask, well, how do I do it? You have heard me in past years say this again and again. You can't put cleanness into the room that is dirty. You can't sprinkle cleanness everywhere and think, oh, everything's lovely. You just remove the dirt and the room is clean. That's that. Now, here is the living house of transcendence. It has to become the temple of the holy, the utterly purified temple. How does this purification of the temple take place? What is our supreme instrument of purification? It is our power of mindfulness, of pure attentiveness. The head tells me, act thus, do this, this is right, this is the noble thing, the fine thing, the self-sacrificing thing, and all the glorious words that we know, and therefore I ought to do it. The heart kicks back in the dark from behind, and it hurts, and it cannot be done. But if I pay attention, complete attention to what the head says, and that is in front of me, it's in the limelight, so to say. If I pay complete attention to it, I will discover all the elements of selfness which are involved in this. Why ought I to do the right thing? because intellectually I argue it will bring me pleasure, health, success, happiness, and something good. I'm preening my ego, my desire for being a good chap, of doing the right thing, my vanity, and all those things are involved in this very, very subtly. I belong to the do-good club. It's not done to do the other thing. Well, I'm just at a not very sensible level. The good thing, the perfect thing happens. It emerges spontaneously, free of any conflict within the psyche. So if I attend intensely to what the head tells me, I will be discovering the deeps within my own psyche. I'll be discovering all those deeps and what forces are actually at play. In addition, I must not condemn any of those forces or praise any of the other forces, because both condemnation and praise are enclosed, tied up within the realm of ambivalence, of something which comes into being, perishes, of mortality. It must be a pure attentiveness, just attentiveness, a looking without looking for anything, an intense looking without wanting to see something. Don't even want to see the truth, the light. See, just look. Really look, really attend. And an extraordinary process of purification of the head will take place. As that proceeds, elements of the heart, out of the dark, out of the deep, will emerge into the light as you look. And you will find that these elements of the heart, which are the springs of desire, of the desire which brings about separation, of dissolution, brings about dissolution, destruction, struggle, pain, all those will come to light. And if one attends to them with the same intensity, it's a terribly difficult task, attends with the same intensity, without any condemnation, without any praise, without wanting to fulfill this or wanting to avoid that, in that state of mind, you will find that the whole of the soul will be completely lighted up. And the conflict will cease. Apply this in one of the most pathetic, one of the really sad problems besetting humanity. The Buddha knew all about it. When the first noble truth was propounded, one of the elements of that noble truth was propounded as being associated with or united with what one does not like, what one dislikes, or not being associated with or united with that which one likes, which one loves. One of the problems that afflicts man, has afflicted man through the ages. Through the centuries, the so-called moral dicta of the great religions laid down, take for instance in the marriage services of the world, until death do us part, and so forth. Then arises the great problem, finally. But this is absurd, this is impossible. And one walks out upon the other. And in this century, especially the post-war generation, so they say, I'm not so certain, they just come together, they are happy, as they say, they find happiness, pleasure, and then something goes wrong, we don't like each other, and off they go. They walk out upon each other. Those who are more stable get faced with this terrible conflict. I have done all my duty, I have done everything. Why should I be any longer subject to my wife or my husband or my whoever it may be? You see, and one is faced with the terrible problem of walking out upon. Then the brain tries to rationalize the situation by saying, but who will look after that person and this, that and the other? I really cannot do such a thing. But am I really considering the other person, or am I considering the pain to myself that I have left that person and done this, and I suffer from remorse? But now look. See truly, deeply, completely. And what is the consequence? One becomes the true disciple, the true learner. One actually learns the truth of life. And that learning, as I have time and again suggested, may be regarded as growing happily. If you regard learning, this profound learning about the art of living, as a growing happily, you will find that all the conflicts which one suffered from, enclosed within ambivalence, have undergone dissolution, and the transcendent wholeness is now present. So, one doesn't, as we ordinarily say, take a positive step with regard to a situation and walk out or not walk out, as the case may be. You see? What one does is that because of this tremendous attentiveness and this inner poise and peace which emerges in consequence of true insight flooding one, one waits until the situation itself changes. You will always find, always, that in the ripeness of time and circumstance, the whole situation will have changed by itself, and you will be completely and utterly free.